Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, an assassination. Japan's former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is fatally shot at a campaign event, rocking a nation that rarely experiences gun violence. Then, employment gains. A strong jobs report staves off recession fears for now, even as concerns about rising prices linger. Plus, protecting abortion. President Biden signs an executive order to ensure abortion access, but stops short of broader measures some activists were hoping for. And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart reflect on the state of our nation after the July 4th holiday is marred by yet another mass shooting. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was gunned down today during a stump speech for a legislative candidate he was supporting. Abe was Japan's prime minister two separate times, with his second stint lasting from 2012 until 2020, when he resigned. His murder sent shockwaves not just through Japan, but across the world, as special correspondent Phoebe Amoroso in Tokyo reports.
What began as a sleepy campaign event became the site of horror, chaos, and the murder of Japan's longest-serving leader, felled by an assassin in the street. Shinzo Abe's death comes as a shock in a country where gun violence, much less political violence, is exceedingly rare. Guns are tightly restricted. The gunman, now in police custody, took aim at Abe from behind. Japanese media say he used a homemade weapon. Video from the scene shows him being pinned down by security. The 41-year-old man, a former member of Japan's Navy, told police he was dissatisfied with Abe and wanted to kill him. Similar weapons were found in his one-bedroom apartment. Current Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his cabinet ministers returned to Tokyo from campaign events after the shooting. Kishida pledged elections for Japan's House of Councillors will still move forward as planned, while he condemned the murder through tears.
This is a dastardly and barbaric act that took place in the midst of an election, which is the basis of democracy.
Abe was the youngest ever prime minister to take office. In 2006, a short stint that ended after a year due to his health. But he returned in 2012 with ambitions of revitalizing the country's suffering economy. His run came to its end when he resigned in 2020, citing a recurrence of ulcerative colitis he had since he was a teenager.
Amid my illness and medical treatment and the distress of not being in full physical condition, there must not be any mistakes made on important political decisions.
He is remembered in part as a nationalist with an unrealized goal of revising Japan's post-World War II constitution that renounces war. His rhetoric prioritized making Japan a normal and beautiful nation with a stronger military and a bigger role in international affairs. Tributes from world leaders poured. President Biden spoke early this afternoon.
This hasn't happened in Japan in decades and decades. I'm told all the way back to the late 30s, the mid-30s.
And beyond the U.S., from South Korea's foreign minister.
The Korean government strongly condemns this shooting incident as violent crime. That should not be tolerated under any circumstances.
And Indonesia's top diplomat.
His dedication to serving his country and people will always be remembered as a prime example for all.
Gun violence is rare in Japan, where there were only 10 gun-related criminal cases last year and just one gun homicide. Japanese people gathered as they processed the loss, paying respects to a leader both divisive and unifying, depending on who you ask.
No matter what you think about his politics, the fact that a man who took such great responsibility and did so much has died in this way is a tragedy.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Phoebe Amoroso in Tokyo.
And now Stephanie Tsai has a more in-depth look at the life and legacy of Shinzo Abe.
Thank you, Judy. I want to bring in Professor Mike Mochizuki, who is the U.S.-Japan chair at George Washington University. Professor Mochizuki, thank you for joining the NewsHour, watching that astonishing video of Shinzo Abe being assassinated, a long-serving world leader taken down with a couple shots from a homemade gun in a country that has almost eliminated gun violence. Professor, what is your reaction and what are the repercussions?
Well, first of all, you know, I want to express my deepest condolences to Prime Minister Abe's family, friends, and colleagues, and to the entire Japanese nation. I mean, this is indeed a horrible tragedy, a shocking development for a country that doesn't experience this kind of violence, and this will be forever etched in the memory of the Japanese. And I think one of the things that's important to note is that you don't have much in terms of gun violence because handguns are completely banned. But at the same time, over the last few decades, attacks on Japanese politicians have not been that rare. And so this will cause, I think, the Japanese to become much more vigilant about providing safety for politicians. But without question, Prime Minister Abe is perhaps the most consequential prime minister that Japan has had since the end of World War II.
Let's talk a little bit more about Mr. Abe's legacy first on the world. What was his greatest impact, sir? He was prime minister from 2012 to 2020. You've got Xi Jinping of China consolidating power. You've got nuclear testing out of North Korea. You have a transition here in the United States between President Obama and President Trump. What really stands out to you in Mr. Abe's legacy on the world stage?
Yes, well, he promoted what he called proactive peace diplomacy, and I think he will be remembered most for his vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific and his efforts to promote security cooperation among Japan, the United States, Australia, and India, what is now called the Quad, or shorthand for the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. He also strengthened the U.S.-Japan alliance by relaxing some of the constitutional constraints on defense policy and pushing for major legislative changes regarding Japan's security role. And he was especially skillful in managing relations with President Trump to prevent Trump from weakening the bilateral security alliance. And I think he was also instrumental in concluding the mega free trade deal known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement with the remaining 11 countries after the United States pulled out during the Trump administration.
Domestically, Mr. Abe wanted a strong Japan, or at least what he called a normal status, away from the post-World War II pacifist constitution, a restoration to some degree of military capabilities. He was clearly still very active in politics on this day he died. What will his lasting impact be on Japan's politics?
Well, he has defined, you know, what I would call a realistic and nationalistic kind of foreign policy outlook. Despite this terrible assassination, I think there will be many within the political class in Japan that will continue to promote his agenda of making Japan have a much more strong defense capability and a much more proactive security policy. But at the same time, it's important to remember that while Abe was prime minister, he contributed to stabilizing relations with China. Before the COVID pandemic in 2020, China-Japan relations had improved to such an extent that Chinese President Xi was slated to make a historic state visit to Japan. And the pandemic derailed that plan, and China-Japan relations have deteriorated again. And in some sense, precisely because Prime Minister Abe was a conservative nationalist, it provided the kind of the political space for Japan to try to stabilize relations with China from a position of strength.
Such a large impact on the world stage, which is why we're seeing condolences pour in from leaders around the world, including from the foreign ministry in China. Shinzo Abe dead at the age of 67 by an assassin in Japan today, a tragic day. Mike Mochizuki, chair of U.S.-Japan relations at George Washington University, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, the U.S. jobs report for June managed to crush expectations despite continuing high inflation and slowing economic growth. The Labor Department reported that employers added 372,000 jobs last month. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate remained at 3.6% for the fourth straight month. Wages also grew, with the average hourly pay rising 5.1%. We'll take a closer look at this right after the news summary. Still on Wall Street, stock prices ended the day mixed over fears that the robust jobs report could mean more interest rate hikes in the future. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 46 points to close at 31,338. The NASDAQ rose 14 points and the S&P 500 fell 3. President Biden signed an executive order today to protect access to abortion and contraception across the country. It was in response to last month's Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, a move that he called a, quote, exercise in raw political power. The president signed the order and urged the country to elect lawmakers to codify abortion rights into law.
In the challenge from the court to the American women and men, this is a nation. The challenge is, go out and vote. Well, for God's sake, there's an election in November. Vote, 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 vote. Consider the challenge accepted, court.
We'll break down what's in the president's executive order later in the program. Meanwhile, a ruling today in Louisiana has allowed that state's near-total abortion ban to proceed. It was one of the latest in a string of court challenges to state abortion laws. Funerals and memorial services began today for three of the seven victims killed in the July 4th shooting rampage in Highland Park, Illinois. Mourners visited a memorial for the victims to pay their respects as the community grieves. Police are still investigating the accused gunman's motive. A wildfire in California is raging out of control near a grove of famed giant sequoia trees in Yosemite National Park. Firefighters are working to contain the flames that threaten the Mariposa Grove, home to 500 of the oldest and largest trees. A portion of the park remains closed after the fire quintupled in size. So far, there have been no reports of damage to the sequoias. Wisconsin's Supreme Court took two steps to restrict voter access today, ruling that absentee ballot drop boxes may only be placed in election offices and that only the voter can return their ballot in person. But the court did not decide whether someone other than the voter can submit a ballot by mail. Elon Musk has notified Twitter's board of directors that he wants to terminate his $44 billion bid to buy the company. He cited a lack of information about fake accounts. Twitter responded that it will now sue Musk to complete the merger. The Ukrainian government says that Russian shelling killed 12 civilians and wounded 30 more over the last 24 hours, mostly in the eastern Donetsk region. Those who remain are fleeing that area by train as Russian artillery continues to pound residential areas. One Ukrainian woman described the horrible choices she's had to make as she boarded an evacuation train with her children.
Can you imagine? I sleep at night with only one thought, that I should cover my child with my body, because in case of shelling, only I would be injured by debris. But I have three children, and I can't protect all of them.
Meanwhile, a regional official warned living conditions have deteriorated in Russian-controlled Severodonetsk. He said residents are without water, power, and a working sewage system, as dead bodies decompose in apartment buildings. And the UN Security Council today failed to extend aid deliveries from Turkey into northwest Syria. Russia vetoed a resolution for a year-long extension and could not get enough support for their six-month proposal either. The UN mandate delivers aid to more than 4 million Syrians who are in rebel-held areas. It's set to expire on Sunday. Still to come on the NewsHour, how President Biden's executive order today could ensure abortion access and where activists say it falls short. Florida moves to restrict what schools can teach about systemic racism. A Pulitzer Prize-winning author delves into the untold story of a racehorse and its caretaker, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Despite worries expressed lately about whether the U.S. is sliding into a recession, today's surprisingly strong jobs report suggests otherwise. The U.S. is average adding nearly 375,000 new jobs a month for the past 3 months, and private sector employment has returned to where it was before the pandemic. But there are still real concerns and warning signs. Inflation, for one. Wages continue to climb, but consumer spending and confidence are down. And the overheated housing market is starting to cool. To get a better read on all of this, I'm joined by special correspondent Catherine Rampell. She is a columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, thank you so much for being here. Should we believe our eyes? Is this jobs report as strong as it looks?
It looks pretty good. We have had several months of continued strong job growth. We have seen wages continue to go up a little bit slower pace than in the past, but that may not be such a bad thing. It looks like unemployment has also remained relatively low. There are, however, some weaker signals, let's say, within this report, including the fact that the labor force participation rate declined. And of course, the jobs market is not the only set of indicators that we look at right now. As you just pointed out, there are a lot of other mixed signals that we're getting from elsewhere in the economy on inflation, on output, on housing, and other sectors.
Well, let me ask you about the strong part of this first, and that is the jobs. Why are we seeing this hike in hiring continuing month after month?
Well, employers are eager to hire, and they are having difficulty, in fact, finding enough people to put onto their payrolls. In the most recently available data on vacancies, it looks like there are about twice as many job openings today, or at least as of a couple of months ago, as there are unemployed workers available to fill those openings. So there is still very strong demand for workers because the economy is still recovering. Again, despite those concerns about recession, and it may still be imminent, I don't want to downplay that. For now, it still looks like employers are very eager to get more people onto their payrolls.
Well, as you mentioned, wages are continuing to rise. But let's talk about, you mentioned the weaker signals here. What would concern you the most? What should concern us the most?
Well, we don't have the inflation data, the consumer price index data yet. For the month of June, the real worry is that once again, when those numbers come in, we will see that in real terms, that is inflation adjusted terms, workers' wages went down. That is, workers are seeing more dollars in their paychecks, but those dollars aren't stretching as far. And as a result, their standards of living are in fact deteriorating. So on the one hand, it is nice to see, I'm sure, that wages are rising at least in nominal terms. If that pace of wage growth does not keep up with inflation, then it doesn't mean all that much to the typical American. Now, the fact that wage growth is slowing, at least in nominal terms, may not be the worst thing in the world if you're worried that the economy is overheating. There's this fear that members of the Federal Reserve, for example, and other economists have that, you know, you could end up in this bad state of the world known as a wage price spiral, where basically workers are demanding higher wages to keep up with the cost of living, and so companies raise prices to be able to pay their workers more, and it feeds on itself. You don't want to end up in that state of the world. So if you do see wage growth cooling a little bit, then maybe that should allay some of those concerns about an overheating job market or an overheating economy.
So in terms of a recession, that conversation has been out there. You're saying it's not happening right now, but you're saying it's still a very real possibility.
Yes, I think the risks of a recession, again, even if it's not right now, have risen quite a bit in the last few months. And that's because we've been hit with a number of unlucky shocks, things like a war, which obviously has other more tragic, serious consequences, but that's also increasing the cost of oil, food, other kinds of commodities, an avian flu, the lockdowns in China that are finally abating, as well as some other risks on the horizon, things like there are labor negotiations at the West Coast ports. And historically, those have led to some disruptions, whether an outright strike or a slowdown. That, if that goes south, that could also disrupt fragile supply chains and drive inflation higher. All of those kinds of factors would raise price growth and cause the Fed to try to stomp on the brakes a little bit more aggressively. And that's the real risk here, that if the Fed needs to slam on the brakes, then they may not just dampen demand, they may accidentally tip us into recession. And that's obviously an outcome that nobody wants.
And clearly, what you're saying is this complicates the job of the Fed already.
Yes.
It's already tricky. It gets even trickier. Catherine Rampell joining us on this Friday afternoon. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
As we reported earlier, President Biden's issued an executive order today to safeguard access to abortion and contraception, a move that comes amid heightened pressure on the White House since the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade. To understand what the president's order does and does not do, I'm joined now by our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón-López. So, hello, Laura. I know you've been reporting on this for a number of days now, but looking at this executive order, tell us first what it does.
So the executive order that the president signed today actually formalizes steps that he directed his agencies to take immediately after the Supreme Court decision. And so this executive order on abortion rights, what it does is it works to protect medication abortion and contraception access, encourages free legal representation for doctors and patients, protects interstate travel for abortions, and ensures privacy for health data. Now, a lot of this is simply telling departments like the Health and Human Services Department to put together a plan. They have 30 days to do that. These aren't necessarily things that are new in terms of expanding abortion access. It's a lot about enforcing current law.
So we know that the president has been under a lot of pressure in recent days from advocacy groups, from Democrats urging him to do more, to do more. Tell us, what were the political considerations here as he worked his way through this?
As you said, he's been facing immense pressure from within his party. And so one of the things politically that the president is trying to do is to draw this contrast. In his speech today, we heard him say over and over, reminding people to go vote, that ultimately these executive actions are not going to reverse the Supreme Court decision, and so that it is all about the November election. And he did talk about, you know, the fact that Republicans, if they gained power, could potentially issue a national ban. That's something that we've heard from a few Republicans across the states, and trying to also draw attention to what different red-leaning states are doing, because he is hoping, as well as his entire White House is hoping, that ultimately that could help Democrats come November.
So it's only been a couple of weeks since the Supreme Court issued, 2 weeks exactly since the court issued this. Laura, is it your reporting that we're going to see more from the president, from the administration on this?
So a lot of what Democrats have been asking President Biden for was not included in this executive action. Their biggest wish list items were not in this. The White House said today, Jennifer Klein of the Gender Policy Council, one of the president's co-chairs, said that they haven't ruled out a public health emergency declaration, although they are very skeptical about the actual impact it would have and the resources and the funds there. They also, so far, have not ruled out the idea of using using Medicaid to fund travel for abortions. Mm-hmm. So we are going to keep a lookout to see whether or not those bigger asks on executive actions come down.
So this is maybe just the beginning. We'll see.
Yes.
Laura Barrón López, thank you.
Thank you.
A new law in Florida is restricting how schools and businesses can address the subject of race. Lisa Desjardins has more on the cultural battles that are playing out in the Sunshine State.
Florida is again in the middle of cultural and political debate as a law went into effect in the last week governing some diversity training on the job and teaching about race at schools. Joining me to talk about this and Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' overall approach is Ana Ceballos, who covers state politics for the Miami Herald. First, to help out our viewers, let me cover what this law does. This law is called the Stop Woke Act, and it essentially codifies a ban on teaching critical race theory, including the concept of white privilege in K-12 schools. It would block businesses from requiring some kinds of diversity and inclusion training, and it would enforce all of that using lawsuits or penalties up to $10,000. Ana, what is the practical effect here? What does each side say this law will actually do?
So the practical effect has yet to be seen because we have just seen this law go into effect July 1st. But we are seeing a lot of concern, really, about how it's going to be enforced because this law is giving a lot of power back to parents in regards to the provisions that apply to schools. So if a parent feels that their child has been instructed to feel anguish or discomfort about a conversation related to their race or national origin in the context of what someone else did in the past, that could potentially trigger lawsuits and impact change throughout the school district.
So it sounds like educators don't know what the parameters are. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, the law is, you know, the law is a law, and you can read the specific language that was approved by lawmakers and signed by DeSantis. But within that, they're pretty broad parameters and guidelines as to what is not allowed. And a lot of it has concerned teachers because a lot of it has to do with feelings, right? How do you regulate and determine that a teacher instructed a kid or a student to feel guilt or discomfort? And so how that is enforced has yet to be determined and has yet to play out in court, whether there's going to be any lawsuits. And so that is currently what teachers are eyeing in terms of what could potentially be in store for them.
Of course, Governor DeSantis has been saying that he's responding to other concerns from parents, and this is part of a series of proposals that he's laid out about what kids should know or access, including transgender care and the gay community, restrictions that he has thought should be put in place. What are the politics of all this, and what exactly do voters in Florida think of what he's doing?
Right. So one thing to know about DeSantis is that since the pandemic, he has really paid a lot of attention to education, and he has really focused on the so-called culture wars and how those have concerned parents specifically. And that has really caused him to be a national star with the political right. And so he's really tapped into the emotions, right, of these parents that are more receptive to conservative culture wars in a way. And so what we're hearing is that he is remaining steadfast in maintaining a approach of being the main fighter against quote unquote woke culture in whether it's higher ed or K-12. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of that through some of the measures that he's backing and some of the noise that he's making in press conferences and how he's advocating and really causing a wave at the national level because he's becoming such a prominent figure in Republican politics that a lot of people are following his lead. And you have to remember that for DeSantis, he's a very strategic governor and he's ambitious. And so I know that he's, you know, listening to the base in terms of what he's trying to embrace. And a lot of what we're seeing right now is, I think, that.
In our last 30 seconds or so, do you have a sense of what voters think of this law and what he's doing?
Well, I think with anything, it depends, I guess, on what voters are talking to, right? Florida's a pretty diverse state. It is trending right since the 2020 election, but it is when it comes to divisive concepts, specifically in education, a lot of it has to do with parents who might be single-issue voters because they care so much about what their children are experiencing firsthand. And so it just depends on specific issues.
Fascinating reporting. Ana Ceballos from the Miami Herald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Guns and abortion rights were once again very much in the news across the country this week. To explore that and more, let's turn to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you,
Judy,
on this Friday night. Thank you for being here. I wish the news were more uplifting, as we were just talking about. David, you know, with the assassination today of the former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, in a country where there's so few, I mean, almost vanishingly few instances of gun violence, and then the contrast to our country, where I looked it up again, over 300 mass shootings already this year in the United States, and then punctuated by the July 4th massacre of seven people. And many more wounded in the Chicago suburb. It reminds us where we are as a country, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've spent the week researching the question, why is it that we seem to have an endless supply of young men who think it's heroic to shoot innocent people? And I learned of several things. One is a lot of us think it's mental health problems, but that's kind of misleading, because the vast majority of the young men who do this do not have mental health problems. It's their circumstances, not any illness. They share frequently some abuse in their past. They often share the idea that they were invisible at school. No one knew them. They felt like they had no friends, extreme social isolation, extreme inwardness. And then they go through a suicidal. And I'm struck by how the experts say this mass killing is in a weird way akin to suicide. Some, they want to end their lives, but they want to do it in a way that'll get them recognized, known. And then guns play a role in their psychology. I think the act of being photographed with guns, suddenly they feel powerful and they feel they've set a plan in motion. They tell themselves a heroic story about themselves. They're defending something. But the most poignant thing I learned this week was from a very fine article by Tom Juneau, the magazine writer in Esquire from 2014. He interviewed a guy who was set out to kill on a mass scale and was caught. And at the end, and years later, he told Juneau, you know, even as I was doing it, I didn't want to do it. If somebody had just pulled me aside and said, you're accepted, I would have broken down and given it up. And so with these young shooters, they often put out a cry for help. But it's just the psychosis in our society that seems to produce a lot of these guys who commit these evil acts.
What does all this say about us?
Well, in some ways, Judy, I think it says we're broken. It also says that we have way too many guns, more than 400 million guns. That's a gun or more per American. If we didn't have the access to guns that we have, would we be seeing these mass shootings? Would these disaffected young men be taking these drastic actions? I sometimes worry whether we will grow numb to the fact that seemingly every week we will see a mass shooting defined as three killed in an incident. I worry that as we grow numb to these mass shootings, we grow even more numb to the daily gun violence that happens in other places. In Chicago proper, that same weekend, more people were killed during July 4th than in Highland Park alone. And so, and one thing you said, David, I'm so glad, I was so glad to hear you say this, that you can't just pin it on mental illness, because I think that's become a crutch. Not everyone who slaughters people is suffering from a mental illness. Some are doing it for the reasons that David said, but we just have to come to terms with the fact that actually there are evil people out there who are bent on destruction. And we can't excuse everything as the Senate Minority Leader did after Highland Park, saying it's mental illness.
I mean, we've had now had several people, David, on this program asked about this, saying there are other countries with young people who have emotional or mental problems, but they don't have as many guns as we have.
Yeah, well, the guns are a clear part of it. If they didn't have guns, they wouldn't be doing it, that's for sure. But I do think it's also true that other countries do not have as many people caught in the circumstances that these young men find themselves. We've had a fraying social fabric, fraying social capital. 54% of Americans say no one knows them well. The number of people who say they have no close friends has quadrupled over the last several decades. There's something going on in the society which is a relational breakdown. And the guns, I don't want to minimize the importance of having 400 million guns in this country, but I also don't want to minimize the fact that at some deep level, we have a society that is extremely cruel on young people. The National Institutes of Mental Health had a study that came out maybe 2 months ago. They said to high school students, do you feel persistently hopeless and depressed? It was 26% like 20 years ago. It was 36 before COVID. It's 45 now. Now, depressed people don't go out and shoot people by and large. Yeah. But it's a sign of some sort of relational breakdown that I confess I don't understand. I don't if social media plays a role, social media is not the main thing going on. Something else is going on that makes us produce a lot of, not even disaffected young men, people who feel the world is attacking them.
I feel we are having these conversations, Jonathan, over and over again, trying to get at whatever it is. Congress passed, I mean, the president signed a bill. Congress finally passed a bill, or did pass a bill related to guns, what, just a couple of weeks ago it was signed. You look at it, wouldn't have had any bearing, apparently, on what happened in Illinois.
Right, that's because Congress just, they pick the low-hanging fruit. The hard stuff they won't do because there aren't votes. The president's doing an event, I believe on Monday, a more formal ceremony acknowledging his signature of that gun law, but more serious action needs to be taken, but it won't be taken until Congress is in a position where there are more people who want to do something. I'm specifically thinking of an assault weapons ban and some other stronger things that could be done. But the current configuration of Congress, that's not going to happen. And I think when it comes to guns, given the Supreme Court decision with New York that completely annihilated New York's gun licensing law, the action now is in the states. It is now with governors who now the onus is on them to do something to protect their citizens, whether it's with guns or whether it's abortion rights, abortion access, because of what the court did.
You agree the likelihood of there being any more federal action on guns is very unlikely.
Seems remote. I've never understood why an Australian-style gun buyback is an affront to anybody. It's an open choice. You can sell your gun or not. But if we're going to reduce 400 million guns, it would take something like that, not even just banning future purchases. I mean, we got 400 million there.
You mentioned abortion access. President Biden did sign this executive order today. We had Laura Barrón-López reporting on that a minute ago, Jonathan. Is this the kind of thing that's going to make a difference, frankly?
No. And I say that not denigrating what the president, what the president and the administration did today. In order to blunt the impact of what the Supreme Court did, you need a federal law. And that's why I think the president was so emphatic today, was so emphatic the day that the court decision came down, was so emphatic when he was at the G7 on foreign soil talking about how extreme the Supreme Court decision is, why voting is so imperative. If you want to codify Roe, the only way that's going to happen is if Democrats maintain control in the House and Democrats maintain control in the Senate with two more seats, in order for something to get passed and to get on his desk. And a lot of the ideas that the activists are saying that are wildly impractical, you codify Roe, you solve that problem. But the immediate thing is, this is not easy. Anyone who tells you that there is a simple solution to this, protecting reproductive rights, is not being honest with the American people, and it's not certainly being honest with themselves.
Because the Supreme Court has spoken.
Right.
David, from the standpoint of this is now something that the states, it's now in the hands of the states, does that mean Washington pretty much, you know, doesn't have a significant role that it can play?
It could. The court said want it settled in a legislature, whether it's a state legislature, it's a federal legislature, that the court said settle it legislatively. I've had an interesting circumstance over the last couple of weeks where I've asked a lot of people on the pro-choice side and on the pro-life side, and the question is, would you take Europe? Would you allow European-style abortion laws just to exist here? And they tend to be they make abortion legal between 12 and 18 weeks, but then they surround the moms and the families with all sorts of social supports. And I've been struck by how many people on right and left, not everybody, but said, yeah, let's just end this and let's settle on that. And that strikes me the way France does it, the way Germany does it, a little more conservative, the way Sweden does it, a little looser. It's like a consensus of where the American people would be. But we can't actually get there because no politician could be in the middle on this issue because their activists on either side would you know, really go after them. And so it's just yet another issue where there's a potential middle ground, but because of the way our politics is structured, we can't get to it.
Impossible to deal with this, waiting for the state, waiting for the election in November.
I mean, well, thankfully, the election is in November. It's this year. It's just a few months away. And that's why I wrote the column that I wrote, Vote, Dang It. This is your one superpower. Your one superpower here in our democracy is the vote. If you want to codify Roe, if you want to do something about gun safety, if you want to do something about voting rights, then you must go into the voting booth and make your voice heard. And given the way midterm elections work, Democratic voters stay home more often than Republican voters. But if Democratic voters come out at presidential voting levels, they will win. Just Democratic voters need to show up.
I'm a little dubious. I think this is going to be an economics election, unless suddenly inflation goes down and the jobs stay. But then we could go to social issues. But I'm a little skeptical.
And then, meanwhile, we all watch to see about voter access, which is another issue in all this. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
A history-making racehorse and the people around it are reimagined in a new work of fiction dealing with obsession and justice. Jeffrey Brown talks to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Geraldine Brooks about her latest novel for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Geraldine Brooks took to writing just around 10 years ago, but she quickly became, in her words, horse-crazed.
You suddenly are interested in learning about horses, acquiring a horse, riding a horse, caring for a horse, thinking about the horse, thinking about how to better care for the horse. It is a consuming interest. Busier. Oh, aren't you beautiful?
Sparkling?
Yeah.
The 66-year-old Australian-born writer began her professional career as a journalist.
Come on, baby. My first job in journalism, after having got a double major in government and fine arts, they sent me to the sports department to cover the races.
Is that right?
She would make her name first as a foreign correspondent and then build a second career as a writer of best-selling historical fiction known for her rigorous research, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning March. In her new novel, Horse, she's again looked to the past, the antebellum South. Brooks joined us recently at Holly Hill Show Stable in Hanover, Massachusetts.
I like to find something on the historical record that is extraordinary, and if you made it up, it would be implausible. It needs to be a story where you can know some fascinating things, but you can't find out everything. So I'm looking for those voids that imagination has to be deployed to fill.
Why do you like it that it would be implausible?
It's what Mark Twain said. Fiction is obliged to stick to possibilities. Truth is not.
This time, the true history is centered on Lexington, a legendary racehorse born in 1850 in Lexington, Kentucky, celebrated in his day, including in paintings, for his victories on the track, as well as for siring numerous other champion horses. It comes out in the book, the importance, for one thing, of horse racing in the antebellum South.
It was not just in the South. It was a national obsession. I don't think that's an overstatement. The only thing I can compare it to, it was a passion like the NFL if everybody played football. In those agrarian days in this country, everybody had a horse or was one generation away from having a horse.
Lexington was a celebrity.
Absolutely. So I stick to riding my own mare because we have an understanding.
Rook's imagination was fired by a reference she read to a now lost painting in which Lexington is, quote, led by Black Jarrett, his groom. Jarrett and other real life figures around the horse became characters in her novel.
But I became most intrigued with the story of the Black Horseman because I hadn't been at all aware that the thoroughbred industry in this country was really built on the skills and the labor of these Black horsemen, many of whom were enslaved or formerly enslaved people.
That is a fairly little known history, I believe.
This is a history that is only now getting a lot of attention from historians, and it really is a remarkable niche within the institution of slavery, because this was a class of men, and they were all men at that time, who had an expertise that was so highly valued that it gave them a kind of a special status, but yet they're still in this brutalizing system where they don't have agency and they can be ripped away from their occupation, they can be sent to another thoroughbred owner, they can have their families torn apart. So it is replete with the tragedy inherent in this system.
But Brooks also wanted to bring the story into our own time, and she found another true life way in. Lexington's bones had been stored, largely forgotten, in the attic of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History. In 2010, the skeleton was restored and sent to the International Museum of the Horse in Kentucky. Brooks created fictional characters around these facts, including a Georgetown University Black art historian, whose story weaves into today's racial tensions and violence.
It is a braided narrative because I wanted to write about the science around the skeleton of the horse at the Smithsonian because it really is fascinating and it's such an extraordinary place to go behind the scenes and see the scientific research that's going on there. So once I knew that the story was coming into the present time, I couldn't leave the story of race back in the 1850s as if this was a story that's over and done, because it so clearly is not over and done.
You also then write in the afterword to this novel, it became clear that this novel could not merely be about a racehorse, it would also need to be about race.
I'm writing this at a time when there is a lot of discussion and a dialogue about who has the right to tell the story. So I'm very aware of that discourse and of the responsibilities inherent in that. I could have written about the horse and the white owners, but that to me would be another unconscionable erasure of the contributions of the Black horsemen. So I knew I was going to have to go there.
We are in this time of very heated debates over cultural appropriation, who can tell a story. You used the word responsibility, I think, that you felt. What did that mean?
It meant doing the work as best I could to get it right. I came to the conclusion that it was better to make the honest attempt than to leave the story untold. And also, you know, I feel like any attempt at empathy, no matter how imperfect it might be, shouldn't be despised because we need more attempts at empathy, not fewer.
The real-life Lexington won his last race in 1855 and died 20 years later. His story and the lives of those around him are reimagined by Geraldine Brooks in the novel Horse.
Come on, little one. Uppy, uppy.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at Holly Hill Show Stable in Hanover, Massachusetts.
Sharon Fontaine Terry is the president and CEO of Genetic Alliance. It's a nonprofit that advocates for advancing genomic research. And tonight, she shares her brief but spectacular take on revolutionizing research.
When my children were diagnosed with a rare disease, it felt devastating. I remember feeling all of a sudden thrown into a world that I didn't choose. I was terrified, and I couldn't imagine having my two little kids be subjected to all the suffering that might come for them and for the loss that we were all gonna feel. When my children were 5 years old and 7 years old, they were diagnosed with pseudoxanthoma elasticum. And we like to say PXE means never having to say pseudoxanthoma elasticum. The kids were diagnosed 2 days before Christmas, and by 2 days after Christmas, a research group came and took their blood. And then a couple days later, another research group called us, and they said, we want to come and take your kids' blood. And I said, well, this first group came, you can call them up. And they laughed and laughed at us, saying, we don't share. In fact, we're in competition with that group. And we realized really quickly that there was no sharing going on in biomedical research. And so I thought there must be better ways to do this. There must be some way that we could figure out how sharing could happen. But I have a master's in religious studies, and so I find myself thrust into a world I didn't understand or know. Fortunately, we had really good people around us who taught us how to run a gel, how to look for a gene, so that we could eventually, in fact, find the gene. And so in the late 90s, early 2000s, I joined Genetic Alliance, became the CEO shortly thereafter, and started to expand and scale and build all the tools I had built for PXE for all diseases. Genetic Alliance is a coalition of advocacy organizations that care about health and disease that work together to try to accelerate research. When it came to data, which should seem to be quite available and easy to share, I started to see that in fact this data was coveted, that one institution would not share it with another. And so finding ways to change the culture of these institutions to allow that they should be sharing all this data, it's been quite remarkable to see this somewhat esoteric idea of ours of sharing data become more popular. People really need to be in control of their data because it's ultimately people that will have to live with the disease. It will be ultimately people that will do the driving of science and research. Today, both of my children are amazing. They're my teachers. They have the manifestations of the disease and continue to progress with it because we haven't found a treatment or a therapy yet. But they're both working on that in different ways. I also have a granddaughter. They both have beautiful wives. And so our family has really been blessed. My name is Sharon Fontaine Terry, and this is my brief but spectacular take on revolutionizing research.
So wonderful to hear that. And you can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And a reminder, don't forget to join Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on Washington Week tonight. That's at 8 Eastern here on PBS. And tune in tomorrow to PBS News Weekend to see one man's journey to find refuge in Poland after escaping Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.